importance of the Sabbath in view of 1844 and the cleansing of the sanctuary. Now, if you've studied God Cares very, very carefully, Volume 2, you will follow me easily on what I'm going to put on the board. And if you haven't, well, you'll learn about it now. This is a part of our study of the Sabbath. You'll think for a minute we've left the study of the Sabbath and we're doing just sanctuary and the book of Revelation. But you stay by and you'll see. Now then, first of all, let's make a diagram of the tabernacle, which is a type of the heavenly sanctuary. And I think many of you will be find it very easy to help me with this. I've got the proportions wrong already. Oh dear, what shall I do? That's supposed to be twice as long. I'll still be wrong. But anyway, there. This is twice as long as that, you understand? No matter what it looks like. Okay. What do we call? Let's see, out here we have a big square thing, and that was the altar of burnt offering. And then there's the laver, which is a place to wash, lavatory. It had water in it where the priests washed, bathed themselves before they went into the sanctuary or tabernacle. Tabernacle means tent. Sanctuary means holy place. The tabernacle was built by Moses. It was replaced later by the stone and wood temple. But it was still a sanctuary. Sanctuary means a holy building or a holy place. But tabernacle means a tent. When you go camping and you set up a tent, that's a tabernacle. This is the tabernacle. What you would put up is a tabernacle, right? Now then, the priests went into the first the first area, which was known as the holy place. How often?
Every day.
In fact, they might go in there several times as their duties required them to. If you were a priest and went in there, what would you see on your left-hand side as you went in? Down here. On the left-hand side, that's the south, actually it was the south, you would see the seven-branched candlestick, the menorah, as the Jews call it today, beaten out of one solid piece of gold. And it was decorated, and the lamps burned up here, olive oil lamps, and the priest was required to see to it these lamps burned continually. On the right-hand side, what would you see in the light? The table of showbread, to use the King James translation. It looks like shewbread, doesn't it? S-H-E-W. But don't forget, that's the same way we spell the word sewing. When ladies sew, that's S-E-W, but we don't pronounce that sue. Women don't sue when they make a dress. They sew. And so, anyway, I said enough on that subject. All right, this is a small table, really, about the size of a piano bench, and gold-plated, of course. This is gold, solid gold. This was gold-plated. And what was on the table of showbread? Well, bread. Special bread. And now, how was it related? It represented, there were 12 loaves. Hey, good for you, fella. There were 12 loaves of bread. That's right. Now, how many piles were they in? Two piles. Now, the Bible says two rows, and some people think that means they were out flat on the table in two rows. But if you take the dimensions of the loaves, which are given precisely, and you try to spread them out in flat rows on the table, whose dimensions are given precisely, they won't fit. So they have to be vertical rows. And no trouble there. So I'm going to exaggerate these because it wouldn't be this high, but I'm going to do it on purpose. Now, before we go any further, all of these things represent Jesus Christ, and then some of them represent other things in addition to Jesus Christ. But let's see, who is the light of the world? Jesus said, I am the light of the world, but he also said, ye are the light of the world. When we become illuminated in our hearts and minds and eyes with Jesus, then his light shines out through us. And then we become the light of the world, reflecting his light. Okay? Now, what did Jesus say in John 6 about bread and himself? I am the bread of life. I am the bread that came down from heaven. And so on. But there were two piles. They're very interesting. You're doing all right, Jerry. One is us and one's God. Now, that's a very logical inference from what we said here. I am the light of the world, ye are the light of the world. Well, I'm not sure that you can do that this time, Jaron. That's a very, very interesting suggestion. Let me tell you something else that I hadn't told you. There are two crowns, golden crowns, around this table. Now, there's one golden crown against what's here, and there's one golden crown around this here, but there are two golden crowns there. Crown suggests kings. Is it possible that this represents the Father and the Son? It's an interesting thought. As I travel around and talk to people who really specialize in studying the tabernacle and the sanctuary, they give me ideas. And that's one of them. Let's carry on. If you were the priest and you were coming in here and you looked there because that's where the light was, and then you happened to look to the right where the light was reflecting, if you look straight ahead, what would you see? A nice little altar. Little golden altar with incense going up. And the priests were required to make sure that that incense was burning there continually. And of course the bread was there continually. But of course bread goes moldy if you leave it. So the bread had to be replaced if it was going to represent the bread of life. Had to be replaced. When was it replaced? On Sabbath. Now, they weren't supposed to do any cooking on Sabbath, excepting the cooking of this bread. It was brought in hot on Sabbath morning and put there. See, we're not to work on Sabbath, but we are supposed to participate in the holiness of the day. So the minister works very hard on Sabbath. The sabbatical teacher works hard on Sabbath. Well, that's not doing our work. That's doing God's work. See? And that's participating in the holiness of the day. All right. Now, the priest went in there every day as needed, bringing in blood from some of the sacrifices and placing them here. And you know about that. A record of confessed sins was transferred to the sanctuary, reminded of God illuminating the world with his light and love, reminded that God feeds us ultimately. If it wasn't for Jesus Christ, there'd be no food anywhere. The cross of Christ is stamped on every loaf, reflected in every water spring. If it wasn't for the cross, we wouldn't even have our daily bread. Satan would have so blighted creation that there would be nothing for anybody to eat. In fact, the human race would have been wiped out long ago. God's grace prevented that. Every meal, in a way, every meal is a little Lord's Supper. We say the blessing, as Jesus always said the blessing before the meal. We say the blessing. We're thanking God really for the cross that made this meal possible. It's a reminder of his grace and generosity. Well, this is the most holy place. Now, frankly, the Bible doesn't always call it the most holy place. Sometimes it just calls it the holy place. It has different names. This room has different names. But whether it's called one name or another, it's all holy, right? Any place God is holy. I think any place God is most holy. It's about as holy as you can be. Holiness ultimately is godliness, isn't it? It can be a burning bush out in the desert. Take your feet off. No, take your shoes off. Take your shoes off your feet, Moses, for the ground where you're standing is holy ground. God was in the burning bush. And later when an angel, Jesus, actually, dressed as a general of the armies, approached Joshua. He said to Joshua, take off Your sandals. Thank you. I was going to say it again. Take off your feet. I've got to get that one corrected. Take off your shoes, your sandals, for the ground where you're standing is holy ground. Any place God is holy. But for convention, this is known as the most holy place. One piece of furniture in here was the ark. Now, I've got to get the Ten Commandments in there, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to 10. First table, our obligations to God. Second table, obligations to our fellow man. Two tables, Moses put them in there, and the Shekinah glory radiating out from here, representing God's presence. And in between here and there was a curtain hung, and a curtain hung here, and then the walls and so on. Well, how often did the priest go in there?
Once a year.
Once a year on the Day of Atonement. I'm going to say more about the implications of that, Lord willing, tonight on the Day of Atonement when he went in to attend to the cleansing of the sanctuary. That's Daniel 8:14. Under 2,300 days then shall the heavenly sanctuary be cleansed. And what that means, I want to go into some of that tonight. Now, take the book of Revelation. Go to Revelation and it's a fascinating thing which was first called to my attention by my twin brother and then in a more organized way by one of my colleagues at the seminary, Dr. Kenneth Strand, that the major prophecies in the first half of Revelation begin with a scene in the sanctuary. Let's follow that through a little bit. Where do you find the seven churches? In chapters 2 and 3. Okay. Now, chapter 1 comes before chapter 2, right? Before we get the prophecies of the seven churches, Jesus reveals himself to John. John is there on the island of Patmos for the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. Seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord. And I heard behind me a voice as of a trumpet. And I turned to see who spake with me. Old John, he's in his 80s or 90s now. He turned. I expect he turned like this. You know, with a little arthritis in his back. He turned as quick as he could. John turned to see who spake with him. And being turned, I saw... This is verse 12, Revelation 1:12. I saw seven golden candlesticks. And then he saw Jesus standing among the candlesticks as the priest who was to keep the lamps burning continually. And these candlesticks, in this case, have an additional meaning. They represent the seven churches, seven eras of church history. And Jesus portrays himself to John and through John to us as a priest who keeps the churches burning if he possibly can. But churches are not just automatic lamps that burn if you put oil in them. Churches are people and they can rebel and refuse to burn. And Jesus has to threaten as we go along and warn, if you won't burn, I'll have to throw you away. But the picture before the seven churches, we are introduced to Jesus standing among the lampstand. In Solomon's temple, the lamps were separate. In Moses, they were all together in one instrument, a smaller operation, but the same idea. Jesus' concern for his churches. Now, let me see. Let's skip over to chapter 8. We're going to have the seven trumpets, which is out of order. Look at the seven trumpets. Verse 2, I think it is, or 6. Before we, the trumpets begin where? In verse 6? Verse 2? Well, let's see, make sure I got it right here, what I'm trying to say. Chapter 8, verse 2. Okay, I saw seven angels which stood before God. Thank you, that's right. And to them were given seven trumpets. These are all symbolic things. Now, before the angels blow their seven trumpets, which are going to take us down through the course of history again, like the seven churches did, another angel came and stood at the altar having a golden censer. And there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. It says out of the angel's hand because the angel was holding the censer. And the angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar and cast it into the earth. There were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. And the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. And the first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth. This is a dramatic moment. Before we hear the seven trumpeters trumpet their portion of the sequence of earth's history, the timeline from John's day to our day, we are first taken to the golden altar, where we see an angel offering incense, representing the prayers of the saints. So we have here, just before the seven trumpets, a scene in the sanctuary at the golden altar. Have you noticed that before? Sure. The trumpet judgments are a response to the prayers of the saints. God promises to look after his people as these judgments descend in response to the prayers of the saints. Now, that's so far so good. The fourth major division in the book of Revelation can be called the Great Controversy chapters, 12 to 14. So will you turn to chapter 12? And see where the sanctuary scene is there. Chapter 12. There appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, upon her head a crown of 12 stars, she even with child cried, travailing in birth, pained to be delivered. Are you with me? There appeared another wonder in heaven, great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, 7 crowns on his heads, and so on. Verse 5, she brought forth a man-child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. Her child was caught up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Now, this is the woman representing the church, gives birth to Jesus Christ. Unto us a son is born, unto us a child is given. His name should be called Wonderful Counselor, Prince of Peace. That's from Isaiah, isn't it? Now, where? Then he goes on to the different prophecies of the great controversy, war in heaven, transferred to the earth. Where is the introductory sanctuary scene here? Sarah Lynn says we should go back a previous verse. Go back to Revelation 11:19. Got it? The temple of God was open in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the ark of his testament, and there were lightnings and voices and thunderings and an earthquake and great hail. Oh, hey, wait a minute. Anybody can do that. Just take the Bible and patch it together any way you want. No. John didn't put the chapters in the Bible. The chapter divisions were put in the Bible in the New Testament 1,000 years after John died. They were put in by an English archbishop who was teaching at the New University of Paris. There's a great interest in Bible study about the year 1200, and there were a lot of Bibles being handwritten for the students and teachers at the University of the Sorbonne, just outside Paris, and the assignments were very difficult for the teachers to give and for the students to follow because there weren't any chapter divisions. So this Englishman teaching at this university, they all talk Latin, these were Latin Bibles, went through and divided the New Testament up into chapters for convenience, and most of the time he did a pretty good job. In Revelation he didn't do as well as he might have. This is the same man who later on became Archbishop of Canterbury in England and helped the lords of England compel King John to sign the Magna Carta, that famous document in British and American liberties. That same man is the one responsible for putting these chapters in the Bible, and he doesn't always get it right. The verses in the New Testament don't come for another 500 years, 300 years after that yet, when another man was wanting to sell a concordance. He devised a concordance, and it was awful hard in his concordance to tell people precisely where to find the words, because the Bible only had chapters. He didn't have verses. So he went through during a busy trip when he was traveling on horseback and staying in hotels at night. I mean hotels, primitive hotels, where you slept, you know, you rented part of a bed, that kind of a thing. And on this trip, he put in the verses. The New Testament. Now, the Hebrews had put in verses and chapters in the Old Testament. We're talking about New Testament. And Revelation is in the New Testament. So, the verses don't always come just right. But pretty well they do. But remember, the chapters and the verses were not inspired by the Bible writers. They were done for convenience later. And sometimes, intelligently, after Bible study, we have good reason to say, hey, this chapter division should have come differently. Revelation 11:19 is the sanctuary text that introduces chapter 12. The temple of God was opened in heaven, and they were seen in his temple, the ark of his covenant. There were thunders and voices and lightnings and a great hail. So, the ark of his covenant contains the Ten Commandments. This is before the great controversy chapters 12 to 14. Now, what's the scene before the seven seals? Well, our time is running by very fast. In chapters 4 and 5, there's a picture of the throne in heaven as it was before 1844. And John sees the throne, and he sees he that sitteth upon the throne. That's a name for God in the book of Revelation. He that sitteth upon the throne, and with him, in the midst of the throne, with him is the Lamb, which is a symbol for Jesus. So we have on the throne and in the midst of the throne the Father and the Son. And it seems logical in this system to say that the throne in Revelation 4 and 5 is symbolized by this table of showbread. And so here we have the seven seals. Now, don't forget there are two crowns around this table. Only one crown around this one, and one crown even around the ark. Two crowns around the table of showbread. Very interesting. Could say a lot more about this. Those of us who have confidence in Ellen G. White's visions will remember that she said in one of her early visions, I saw a throne, and on it sat the Father and the Son. There came a flaming chariot to where the Father sat. He stepped into it and was borne into the holiest and sat down. Then a little later, another flaming chariot of clouds and so on came to the Son. He stepped in it and was borne into the holiest where the Father was. And what Ellen G. White appears to have seen in her vision was Daniel 7:13, the Son of Man on the clouds of heaven, from the camera angle of the holy place. And what Daniel saw in vision, thrones were set up, the Ancient of Days took his seat, and then on the clouds of heaven, the Son of Man came. Daniel saw that same scene from the camera angle of the most holy place. Get it? Same event in 1844. Now, notice that in the book of Revelation, there is progress. We first of all have the lampstands as an introduction, then the throne in the holy place as an introduction to the seven seals, then the golden altar as an introduction to the seven trumpets. And in each of these cases, the introductory sanctuary scene focuses our attention on a special message that God is trying to get through to us in connection with the seven churches, the seven seals and the seven trumpets. And that's another sermon in itself, and I would love to talk to you about all of that. I did touch on the fact that here Jesus portrays himself as the priest who cares for every church and does his best to keep the light burning smoothly and sweetly and cleanly. And here, heaven is interested in the prayers of the saints, no matter how tumultuous the times may become. And here, the souls under the altar, the persecuted saints of the Middle Ages, cry out, "Oh God, how long before you pay attention to us? It seems so much trouble they're going under and so much joy up in heaven in Revelation 4 and 5. It seems angels coming and going, thunders and voices in Revelation 4 and 5, angels singing praises to God, holy, 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 day and night, Revelation 4 and 5, when these poor persecuted souls under the altar, "Oh God, how long before you pay attention to us and judge us?" When I got to this, when I was writing God Cares, suddenly my prayers were all messed up. I had to think when I knelt down to pray that heaven is full of angels and thunders and voices and songs and rainbows and everything. It was so much nicer when I thought it was just Jesus and me visiting together. Why, I couldn't be heard by God through all that noise if I shouted. That bothered me for several days. And then I looked back again at Revelation 5 and saw what the angels were singing about. "Worthy art thou to receive honor and glory and power, because thou hast died, and with thy blood thou hast redeemed men and made them kings and priests." Oh, so that's what the singing is about. It's about us and God. And all those thunders, that's God commanding the angels, "Go quick and help that person now." Oh, I felt better now. Now I guess it's good to have all that commotion up in heaven. It's all done for us. See? Soul under the altar. "Oh God, why don't you listen to me? What do you think I'm doing, friend?" Listening for all I'm worth. Doing the best I can. And then I remembered that once Jesus was persecuted and killed and thrown into a grave, he was once a soul under the altar. He knows all about this. He was slain to redeem us. And now that sanctuary scene in Revelation 4 and 5 had a whole new meaning. When I feel persecuted for others who do in the fifth seal. So each of these introductory sanctuary scenes has a beautiful message that helps focus the intention of the seven churches, seven seals, and seven trumpets that follow. Now, notice this. Revelation 11:19, the introductory sanctuary scene is in the most holy place, and it focuses on the Ark of the Covenant, the Ten Commandments. Now, what do you get in Revelation 12-14? We go through the 1260 days three times, lickety-split. And get down in Revelation 12:17 to the remnant. Look it up. Come on. You all know it. You can say it with me if you don't need to look it up, if you know it by memory, and you probably do. We go down through the 1260 days, persecution. We go down through it again, and then we get to the remnant of the woman's seed, they which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And then we come again, we get the three angels' messages, fear God and give glory to Him, and the call to worship the Creator of heaven and earth, that Sabbath, that's right out of the fourth commandment. And then what happens? The people who respond to this message, Revelation 14:12, here's the patience of the saints, here are they that keep the commandments of God and have the faith of Jesus. Now, it is when we get to the great controversy, chapters 12-14, that for the first time in the book of Revelation, God's people are specifically identified as commandment keepers. You get the connection between the Ark of the Covenant and the commandment keepers. And these commandment keepers appear in prophecy after the 1260 days, after 1798. They appear after the announcement in the first angel's message, the hour of his judgment has come, after 1844, the end of the 2300 days. It's when Jesus enters the most holy place of the heavenly sanctuary, Daniel 7:13. The Bible predicted a revival of commandment keeping, Sabbath keeping, in the end time, in connection with 1798-1844. We look back through history and we find an indifference to the Sabbath, or people keeping Sabbath on Sunday. Whatever, God blessed as He could, but He promised that in the end time there would be a restoration of the Sabbath, and He would call people into the joy of Sabbath keeping. And those who had Jesus in their hearts and faith in Jesus would vibrate to this. They would be sensitive. They would respond. As Jesus moved on their hearts, they would accept the testimony of Jesus. They would have the faith of Jesus. And responding would keep the day that Jesus especially set apart, that Jesus kept Himself when He was on the earth. Very, very Christ-centered. And all who love Jesus, sooner or later, want to do it. Yeah. Even if the wife has to say to the husband, "I don't mind if we live in a tent. I want you to be a Sabbath keeper." Yeah. Isn't that right? Beautiful. Well, that's the first half of what I wanted to do with you. I guess I better stop, huh? Well, I have been carrying around in my pocket this coin. And I know these lads would like to see it. And so I do have 5 more minutes. Let me tell a story out of our Adventist history. I would lead up to it. It'll take me a couple of minutes. During the Middle Ages, real quick, I'll just skim through this. During the Middle Ages, you know, the Sabbath was largely lost sight of in Western Europe. And people kept Sunday, more or less. They kept 150 other holy days. When you have 200 holy days in a year, you can't keep any day holy, right? Not made to. So instead of being holy days, they became holidays. You went to church if you felt you couldn't get out of it, and then the rest of the day you weren't allowed to work hard, but you sure didn't keep it holy. So then you have no day really holy. When Martin Luther came along for his Reformation, he did away with all the holy days. Even Sunday. But he said, "You've got to come to church someday in the week, and we're used to going to church on Sunday, so we'll keep going meeting on Sunday." But it isn't the Sabbath. It isn't holy. But he did stress the Bible and the Bible only. The Reformation in England led to a revival of holiness, one holy day a week, on Sunday. It didn't occur to them it could be Saturday. And it's now, around 1600, that the English people began to call Sunday Sabbath. It's the first time Sunday was called Sabbath. It's around 1600 in Great Britain. And actually, it was a great advance. Because at least they were going to keep one day in the week holy. And no other days. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work. And they taught a very beautiful Sabbath keeping. A very beautiful Sabbath keeping on Sunday. They had the wrong day, but they had the right way. And some of those folks believed in the Sabbath on Sunday so strongly that they left England and went to Holland at great personal expense. And from there, they came to America and founded Plymouth Colony so they could keep the Sabbath. Take your hats off to them. In that desperate winter, when they didn't have any place yet to land, to live in on shore, and the Mayflower captain was eager to leave, every Sabbath, that is Sunday, they refrained from work and worshipped. That's what they'd come for. Freedom to keep the Sabbath. Wrong day, right way. These Puritans became the Congregationalists, the Presbyterians, and in America, the Baptists. These three great denominations started out with one of their major premises that you should keep the Sabbath holy. Right way, wrong day. When you have this happening, somebody's going to say, "Wait a minute. Why don't we keep it on the right day?" So you have in Britain the Seventh-day Baptists starting out. John Trask, persecuted. Set upon the pillory at Westminster. Are you picturing a pillory? You know, you put your hands through and your neck through, close it down, throw things at you for hours. Thence whipped to the Fleet and imprisoned there. Pauline Stanley and I did that. We didn't have the stocks, but we did walk for 2 miles. We weren't whipped. John Trask was tied to the back of a wagon and beaten all the way for the Sabbath, keeping Sabbath. That wasn't very nice. English people should have done better than that, don't you think? Couldn't understand it. Saturday Sabbath keeper was bad enough to have Sunday Sabbath keepers. But Saturday Sabbath keepers, those were really weird. His wife Dorothy was put in prison and died in prison after 17 years. And don't think a prison was a nice clean place with a bed and running water and TV to watch. It was a place where you had straw on the ground and rats, and you were lucky if somebody brought you food to put it through the bars. 17 years. But she said prison walls do not. Let's see, iron walls. Stone walls are not a prison bank, nor iron bars a cage. Dorothy Trask was a Sabbath keeper. Very intelligent woman who taught people how to learn to read English when they were very young. Kind of a Head Start program she had. Brilliant woman, but she kept Sabbath. Weird. John James, the First Assembly Baptist preacher in Mill Yard Church, was accused of treachery, treason, and sentenced to be hanged, drawn, doesn't mean to draw blood. In this case, it means to draw the whole heart. Some of you folks who draw blood, this is more vigorous than that. Hang, drawn, and it's a kind of surgery. It's terminal. When they nail you up in different parts of the city. This is barbaric. Because he was a Sabbath keeper. Then there was Peter Chamberlain, whose father invented the surgical forceps used to help difficult births. Here's medical missionary work. Peter Chamberlain was so valuable to the royalty and nobility of Britain that though he was a Sabbath keeper above 30 years, he lived and died a natural death. Medical missionary work. How about that? He was too valuable to be treated like John James and the others. His grave is still there in eastern England. You go there and read the inscription on it. Little churchyard. The Seventh-day Baptists came to America, got off to a fairly slow start. From then, Seventh-day Adventists learned about it. Ellen G. White had a vision after she became a Sabbath keeper. And she was shown Jesus holding up the Sabbath in the most holy place of the heavenly sanctuary. And she said, we are to go out and proclaim the Sabbath more fully. Key phrase, more fully. More fully than whom? More fully than the Puritans, the Congregationalists, the Baptists. They had the right way but the wrong day. Proclaim the Sabbath more fully than the Seventh-day Baptists, who had the right day and the right way, but had no sense of urgency. Didn't realize there was a special time in earth history for the Sabbath. More urgent than that, as we think of the fulfillment of the 2300 days, the prophecies about the seal of God, the mark of the beast, that now is the time to proclaim the Sabbath into all the world. Come quick, come out of every religious organization now to keep the Sabbath as part of this end time message. Proclaim the Sabbath more fully. 1844, the 2300 days, has a great deal to do with our understanding of the specialness of the Sabbath. Leave out the 2300 days, leave out the three angels' messages, and you become a Seventh-day Baptist. And after 300 years, there were only 60,000 Seventh-day Baptists in all the world, and one of their historians told me 30,000 of them don't really count. But he was very honest with me, and that was nice. Seventh-day Adventists, well, we have 7 million. Some of them don't really count. They're not really Sabbath keepers, but they're on the books. But there's something different in the way we present it from the way they present it. There's an urgency to it. And a sacrifice. And now my story about the York shilling, and then I better stop. After Joseph Bates was convinced that the Sabbath should be kept because it was time for the third angel's message, he wrote several tracts on the subject, right? And when he was writing one that was more than 100 pages long, he was reduced to a York shilling. And Jaron, I got it here for you because I knew you would like to see a York shilling. Would you like to see it? Okay, some British coin. Americans didn't have enough silver in 1846. They didn't have enough silver to make their own coins. America didn't have enough silver to have much of it, many of its own coins in circulation until after the Civil War and New Mexico and Arizona mines opened up. So they used European coins. And this is a British coin and York shilling. And there were Austrian coins and Spanish coins and Mexican coins, but very, very, very few American coins in circulation. So I like to think this is the very same York shilling that Joseph Bates had in his pocket. And I always say to people, well, you can't prove that it isn't. So maybe it is. Maybe it is. Oh, yeah, you can look at it. You can show it to your brothers if you like. Anybody else wants to see it afterwards, I guess I'll get it back. You can see. You know the story. Joseph Bates was writing this book about the Sabbath to circulation among the former disappointed Adventists. And while he was writing, he'd been a sea captain, hadn't he? He had sold the ship, and his part, his interest in the ship when he retired was about $10,000 or $11,000. But he had been giving this away in the Millerite Second Advent movement. And he'd been giving it away since 1844. As he traveled to help people find new courage in the Lord and begin to keep the Sabbath. And his wife didn't realize how very poor he had become. His wife's name was Prudence. She didn't think it was prudent not to have any money left, you understand? So she's cooking in the kitchen. You know the story, but it's nice to review it. She's cooking in the kitchen and he's writing on this book. By the way, the book was finally discovered just about 10 years ago. It had been lost all this time. And somebody found a copy of the actual book, and that's just nice to have. She came in and said to her husband, I'm out of flour to finish the baking. And he asked her, how much flour do you need? Which is a surprising kind of a question, because he used to buy it by the barrel, like he did when he went on his sailing vessel voyages. And so, but she said, well, 4.5 pounds, something like that. All right, so he finished the paragraph. He was writing, you know, like husbands do. And then after a while, he got up and went out. And when he came back to the house with the 4.5 pounds of flour and a few other things, he set them down on the kitchen table and went back to writing. Don't you know this story? He went back to writing on his book, The Vindication of the Sabbath. And after a while, his wife came into his study and said, Joseph, what's this stuff on the kitchen table? Where did it come from? And he said something like, well, I thought you asked me to get it for you. But just a little sack of flour? Well, isn't that what you said you needed? But Joseph, I don't understand. You always buy provisions for us by the barrel. And he said, Prudence, I spent for those few things the last money I have on earth. Oh, Joseph, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And he rose up to his full height, his commanding stature as a sea captain, and said to Prudence, Prudence, dear, the Lord will provide. The Lord will provide. And she was not yet a Sabbath keeper. So she was a good Christian. And she burst into tears and said, oh, that's what you always say. The Lord will provide. And she went away and cried for a long time. I mean, this was serious. This was terminal there. Her husband was so committed to this Sabbath thing that he was willing to run completely out of money. What is going to happen to us? It's a very good question. What is going to happen to us? What are we going to do? So she had reason to cry. And then he was impressed to go to the post office, that there was money there for him. So he walked down to the post office, and there was a letter for him, but didn't have the postage paid. In those days, you didn't have to pay the postage. you could either pay it or the recipient could pay it. Yeah? Before all this junk mail was done that way. At the end of that. I'm sorry, I don't have the 5 cents, sir, he said to the postmaster. The postmaster thought he meant that Captain Bates, the man who retired from sea, you know, with $11,000, that he just meant he didn't happen to bring the money with him. By the way, he didn't say it's a nickel, because he didn't have nickels. He said 5 cents. Cents were made of copper, so he had cents, big ones, 5 cents. And you, well, that's all right, Captain Bates, why you just take the letter and you pay me next time you're in town. That postmaster knew he was one customer he could trust. And Captain Bates responded, no, sir, thank you. But the Bible says, owe no man anything. Well, that's one way to handle your finances, isn't it? No credit cards for him. No big debts. Owe no man anything. It's not bad advice. Owe no man anything. But I believe there may be money in there. Mr. Postmaster, would you open the envelope? And if there is money in there, will you take out the 5 cents and give me the change? The postmaster opened the envelope. There was $10 in there. Now, at 50 cents a day for a laborer, that's 2 or 3 weeks' wages. That's a good bit of money. And the postmaster was a good sport, because this was a $10 bill on some other bank out of town, and these banks fail overnight, many of them. But the postmaster trusted the bank and took the $10, took out 5 cents, and gave Mr. Bates, Captain Bates, the $9. Hey, what? When you take 5 cents away from $10, how much is left? 5 cents out of $10, $9 and. Yep, you got it. $9.95. That's right. $9.95. You got it. And he went to the grocery store and bought a barrel of flour and a bunch of other things. And he said to the drayman, that'd be the man that would drive the horse-pulled wagon to the house, when you get to the house, the lady of the house will tell you, we can't afford this. She'll put up a fuss, but you deliver it anyway, because it's paid for. So he went to the stationery store and bought some pens and paper, give the drayman time to get it delivered, looked up the street to make sure it was there on the front porch where he thought it would be, because he knew his wife wouldn't let it in the house. And he went up to the house and sneaked in and sat down at his desk and started writing. Pretty soon, Mrs. Bates comes into the room, quite agitated. Joseph, what are we going to do? What do you mean, what are we going to do? Well, the drayman came with all his stuff, a whole barrel of flour and all kinds of other things. And I told him, I'm sorry, there's a mistake. We can't afford this. No, this doesn't belong here at our house. You must mean somebody else's house. We can't afford it. And he insisted on delivering it, Joseph. Oh, we can't afford it. You told me we couldn't. What are we going to do? Well, dear, didn't I tell you that the Lord would provide? Oh, that's what you always say. And then he stood up to his full height as a captain, and he took out of his pocket the letter that had come with the money and showed it to her. Dear Brother Bates, the Lord has impressed me that I should send you money to help you with the publication of the Sabbath message. Please accept the $10 enclosed. Yours in Christ and the blessed hope, something like that. And no name. He never did find out who sent the money. God sent it, so it was okay. Do you see, Prudy? The Lord did provide. Oh, I should never have been doubting. I'm sorry, I'm such a sinner. And she went away and cried for another hour, the old story says. But they were very different tears this time. And very soon, she became a Sabbath keeper too. So our Sabbath has come to us from the Scriptures and through prophecy. and through sacrifice, people who loved it, and it's well worth keeping today. Right? Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for the Sabbath. Help us to keep it in Jesus. And bless us in the rest of today for Christ's sake. Amen.
You have been listening to Dr. C. Mervyn Maxwell in association with American Cassette Ministries. International copyright 1994, American Cassette Ministries. All rights reserved. Christian ethics prohibit reproduction in any form. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. For additional cassettes by American Cassette Ministry speakers, please call our toll-free order line 1-800-233-4450. Thank you for ordering American Cassette Ministry cassettes. Your prayers and continued financial support are extremely important as together we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ.